Welcome to After All Art School's podcast.
After All Art School is a multimedia platform for collective reflection on the present and potential futures of teaching and learning about and through art. The current crisis for art schools around the world has major implications not only for the labor and practice of teaching and learning in the field of art, but also for the labor and practice of art making itself, encompassing essay series, live open discussion groups, and a reference hub for further reading, watching, and listening. Art School engages with the present's most urgent questions around education and art. We are your hosts and co-editors,
Camille Critchlow
and Ariana Mercado.
This podcast series was created in collaboration with the Kunstverein in Hamburg's exhibition, The Educational Web, which ran between April 1st to August 6th, 2023. This exhibition took the theorist, educator, and decolonial thinker Ivan Iklik's seminal 1971 book, Deschooling Society, as a point of departure, generating dialogue between art and the pedagogic practices that underpin it.
The Educational Web brought together the work of 8 schools, educational organizations, and independent study programs, which define themselves as alternatives to the traditional art academy. Over the course of the exhibition, we at After All Art School initiated a series of online interviews and a growing library physically present at the Kunstverein. We collectively think through 3 different strands: education as learning together, problematizing the decolonial institution, and studying in the shadows.
For this episode, Zach Blass is in conversation with Camille Critchlow, myself. Enjoy this recording. So without further ado, I'm very pleased to welcome and introduce Zach Blass for our conversation this evening, or for Zach this afternoon. Zach is an artist, filmmaker, and writer whose practice spans installation, moving image, computation, theory, and performance. Blass is an associate or assistant professor of visual studies in the Daniels Faculty of Architecture, Landscape, and Design at the University of Toronto. Zach has exhibited, lectured, and held screenings at the Whitney Museum of Art, Tate Modern, Walker Art Center, and many more, and also has an upcoming solo exhibition in London entitled Cultus at Arbeit Gallery from the 12th of October until mid-February. So do check that out if you find yourself in London. My name is Camille Critchlow, and I am a project coordinator and co-editor of Art School at After All Research Center at Central St. Martin's. I am also a PhD student at University College London, where my research looks at historical and emergent formations of racialism manifest in contemporary techno-visual cultures. I wanted to begin this conversation on theme with our topic this evening, just orienting ourselves within your kind of educational history. So to get started, can you situate us in your educational anchoring? What were the kind of objects of fascination, texts, experiences, whether this was inside or outside of the classroom, which have shaped and informed your work as an artist, writer, and educator?
Sure. First, let me just say hi, Camille. And, you know, we almost had a different brush with studying and having pedagogical exchange in a different way years ago in London. So it's nice that we get to do this together. And thank you for inviting me. Situating my practice, I could talk about that for a while, or my educational practice and just my educational background. I have quite a wide training in a variety of academic disciplines. And I think, you know, when I was younger, I think naively had a certain kind of aspirational, understanding of what academia can deliver and promise, and given my working class background. And, you know, I studied film production, I studied fine art, digital media, I did an MFA in digital art, and then I went on to do a PhD in critical theory and philosophy. And, definitely all of those different areas of study, film, visual art, philosophy. And I mean, you know, when I say philosophy, it was more a mix of, you know, media theory, science and technology studies, feminist theory, queer theory, that all that's really come together, where I'm at now with my teaching. And at University of Toronto, which is where I teach now, I teach in this program called Visual Studies, which is this like tiny, tiny little island of a program that is kind of hidden, tucked away inside an architecture school. But within this program, I teach, you know, grad, postgrad, undergrad level classes across a range of, you know, art practice studio classes and theoretical topics. So right now, I actually just taught my first class of the academic year yesterday. And my undergraduate class is called Artist Writings. And this is in part a survey class that's introducing students to artists that have writing practices, you know, whether that's critical, creative, somewhere in between, and students study these writings and they also develop their own writing practice. So it's kind of combination seminar, lecture, studio. And then my graduate class starts tomorrow, and that's called Art and Theory Today. And that class is a just broad theoretical survey in theoretical topics active in art today, you know, whether that's looking at the forensic turn, something like, you know, looking at the work of forensic architecture, Susan Shupley, or focusing on decolonization, thinking about the impact of Black studies, like people like Sylvia Winter. It's like quite wide ranging and meant to give students graduate students an introduction to how theory, discourse, and philosophy are active in the field of art today. Mm-hmm. And okay, so I know I could, you know, maybe I'll just, you did ask about like objects and people and things. So maybe I'll end with that. And, you know, I never really saw myself as an academic. I definitely saw myself as an intellectual, or, you know, I aspire to be an intellectual at an early age, but I was never that interested in being an academic. And that just really kind of happened out of a set of like practical and financial, you know, reasons. But I would say that I had some pretty, you know, important experiences with professors and works at different stages of my life. I mean, definitely when I was an undergrad, I took this video art class by this professor, Roy Grundman, who teaches at Boston University, and getting to see works by like Derek Jarman, Martha Rossler, Marlon Riggs at a really young age were like absolutely, you know, mind-blowing, self-shattering in the best of ways. And then when I was doing graduate work, I definitely felt like I was kind of lost somewhere between my interest in queerness and queer art and digital media and computation. And I think in the early 2000s, when I was doing this, like we're at a really different place now. And there wasn't a lot of space that I could find to productively bring these together. But when I was at UCLA doing my master's, my MFA, I met in Catherine Hales, the media theorist in Catherine Hales. And she just kind of took me under her wing. I don't know why, but I'm extremely grateful that she did and gave me this incredible media theoretical education. And then simultaneously, because I was living in Los Angeles, I met Jack Halberstam, who was teaching at USC, a different school in LA at the time. And I started having meetings with Jack and having more informal exchanges, which is really how I got my kind of queer theoretical foundation. And then, I mean, it's funny, a lot of this was actually not at the school I was studying at. And then I also met Ricardo Dominguez when I was living in Los Angeles, the artist who teaches at UC San Diego. And now I remember seeing Ricardo speak for the first time, and it was like Cupid's arrow, like to the heart. Like I was just so enamored and so in love with him and just so in awe that someone could, you know, do what he was doing inside an academic institution. And so San Diego is only a 2-hour drive away from LA. So I spent, you know, time with Ricardo then. And I think, you know, between Kate Hales and Jack Halberstam, it was like encountering, I don't know, like an early work like Sadie Plant, Zeros and Ones, or Halberstam's really early essay on Alan Turing, finding these works that brought queerness and digital media and computation together were really, you know, set me on a path for sure.
Mm-hmm. Incredible, incredible. It's amazing also how that early foundation of these kind of informal networks kind of also finds expression or a kind of ethos in your own artistic practice, right? Because you use a lot of these research-based practices and also collaborations to kind of delve into the topics that you explore in your work, right? So I want you to think a little bit more about your research-based practices and the relation with art making. You know, how does your approach to research and study inform this approach to art making? And also, how does the act of making inform your approach to pedagogy or learning or teaching?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I think all of the artworks that I make are definitely driven, motivated by, you know, a strong interest and passion I have in theoretical research, historical research. You know, I'm a little like looser with this, but I think a lot about concept engineering as one way to think about how is all the theoretical research I'm doing that's going into the work, like, you know, how is that, I don't know, becoming manifest in the work, but also holding space beyond maybe the visual artwork or the installations. And one way I've done that is, concept engineering and creating a theoretical concept that becomes a discursive framing for the work that I'm making. And I like that the concept can have a life beyond, you know, the artwork as we know it. So, you know, an example of this would be something like informatic opacity, which is something I developed, you know, a long time ago now, around thinking about biometric facial recognition and minoritarian kind of acts of refusal in relationship to that, or another concept like contra internet, which was this act of utopian plagiarism with post internet and Paul Preciado's idea of contrasexuality. That's one way I've, worked with that. And I guess I see the artwork as it's also in conversation, just how writing is in conversation with, you know, theoretical ideas. I see the work as being in conversation with theoretical intellectual debates, other writings, just as much as I want the artwork to be experiential, emotional, you know, affective in its aesthetic manifestation. Mm-hmm. How does making inform my pedagogy? I mean, it's an interesting question because I'm just thinking about class yesterday in the artist writing class, and the students, we did a collective reading of Maria Fusco's 11 statements on art writing, which was written, I think, in 2011. And the first statement there is art writing emerges as a practice. So one of the first kind of breakdowns we do there is to resituate writing as a practice and not, you know, kind of have a classical separation between theory and practice. So maybe one way to think about making in the pedagogy is that I would see writing as a mode of making. You know, it's all practice. Whether it's writing, whether it's performance, whether it's, you know, making an installation or a video. And so I'd say, you know, pedagogically then, I try and with my teaching definitely to set the stage where that's not overdetermined, where, you know, students are able to essentially, I don't know, kind of like figure out their own criteria that they need to approach practice and think about the forms that are necessary or required or needed based on what they're trying to make, express, communicate in relationship to the historical present and how they are situated in the world. I think the class, you know, the classroom for me is like, it's holding fluidity between writing as we know it and then artwork, and just really wanting students to figure out their own criteria. I mean, I think that's one of the advantages, or at least I would see, of an arts education, because I've kind of walked both paths in a way where I did a formal arts education, but I also have a PhD in critical theory and philosophy. And that was like not a practice PhD, you know, that was like a straight up standard academic PhD. And just kind of seeing the tendencies and kind of ideological underpinning on either side of the equation of those modes of education, where art school is often about innovation. You know, it's like the work isn't cool if you're inhabiting a form that's already played out. Whereas with academic education, it's almost like the form is platonic, where there's the platonic ideal of academic writing. You will forever fail to perfectly achieve it, as you will learn in peer review and professorly feedback, but you will still try to like reach that form. And I guess I would say I'm maybe trying to walk a different way, where it's not, fetishizing the idea of innovation, but it's not taking form for granted and kind of having an interrogative, self-reflective, mindful approach to form you and have it, and being aware that, right, material forms have different affordances and limitations. There's something that you can do with a piece of writing that maybe you can't do with a more experiential installation, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's also, right, having that awareness of the possibilities, the limitations of these forms as you figure out how you want to, you know, work your way through them.
Yeah, I wanted to pivot to some of the kind of interest, the political interest in queerness and also technologies of capture that you take up in a lot of your writing and also in your art practice, because you're kind of straddling multiple mediums of engagement, right, with these kind of ideas and questions. So yeah, I wanted to turn to some of the kind of techno-political topics that you engage in your practice. Quite a few of your artworks explore the ways in which biometric algorithms see with normative vision, to the effect that queer and minoritized bodies are often misread or fail to be recognized entirely, right? So for example, trans people are often misgendered by facial analysis algorithms, and Black faces, particularly Black women's faces, often fail to be recognized by facial recognition systems, and so on. And as you mentioned, in response to this, you've kind of called for a queer tactics of defacement as a means to refuse the standardized categories imposed on queer and minoritized bodies. So I wanted to ask, in terms of staying on the topic of education, I wanted to ask if we can think of these biased functions of biometric tech and other computer vision technologies. Can we think of these functions, these functional kind of normative exclusions, as a machine pedagogy or a kind of educational model which selectively learns and reinforces normatively legible categories? Because this seems to be kind of like a consistent theme in your work, right? And is an alternative machine pedagogy possible? And can it be accomplished through a kind of queer tactics of defacement? And what would this look like? I know this is like a big question, but we can just dive right into it and go one by one.
It's a juicy question.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely, if I like the way that you put that, you know, attending to the questions of capture, you know, that I started thinking about, you know, when I was still a student, you know, thinking about those, the issues, the biases, the limitations, the standards, you know, whatever the terminology is you decide to attach to it and focus on. Yeah, I mean, it seems like that would be some kind of, you know, pedagogical structure to let us have a sense, you know, kind of practically speaking, experientially speaking, of the issues kind of being confronted with here. And maybe that's one of the affordances that could come in with an arts education, where you have an opportunity to experiment technically and, you know, bring in technology into the classroom, not to have this, you know, we're bringing this technology in to perfect, like, professional level mastery of it, but to, you know, either play with it or interrogate the technology, you know, as a means of gaining types of knowledge. And I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I've seen that happen, you know, in my classes in different ways throughout the years, where, you know, last year I had someone experimenting with race and machine learning to try and highlight certain kind of standards and pitfalls there. But I think also, you know, I would, you know, what comes to mind is thinking about connecting this to like a longer mode of thinking. And so another thing that I think we could do is build a vocabulary. And, you know, what I used to do when I was still at Goldsmiths in the Department of Visual Cultures, I taught an undergraduate class there called the Arts of Surveillance. And the first 5 weeks were just vocab building. And it was really like trying to, you know, set the stage by saying, you know, surveillance is one of these words that says everything and nothing. It's just like a really unuseful word, although we often kind of fall into using it. So can we build more specific vocabulary that actually might allow us to attend and focus on some of the minoritarian concerns? And, you know, of course, this work is like only accelerated, and many people now are doing this kind of work. But, you know, just to kind of get us started as a couple examples or a few examples, I was always taken with this idea of Capture by Phil Agra, who used to teach in information studies at UCLA. And back in the early 90s, he wrote some really early studies on facial recognition. And he put forward this model of Capture as a way of kind of thinking about processes that we might want to call computational surveillance, but he argued for the use of the term capture instead. And you know, what I thought was interesting about capture was, and the way that he framed it around kind of algorithmic standardization, is it starts to help you kind of think and attend to questions of standardization, how identities or the capture of identity becomes standardized and produces a grammar. And I think that language of capture, at least back then for me, was much more helpful to try to think about some of the more queer minoritarian concerns that I was interested in. And I mean, it's also why essentially there, I was trying to set up a dynamic between, and I know we'll get to this eventually, rather than surveillance privacy, which was always this like dyad of talking about these issues, what if we talked about capture and opacity instead? And, you know, what kind of frame does that open up? So, I mean, just thinking pedagogically, the way that things, of course, are conceptually demarcated can open up different ways of seeing and focusing on, and attenuating to certain aspects of the political problems. And, I would also think of something like Donna Haraway's God Trick here as well, again, kind of vocab building and thinking about the God Trick as, the kind of fantastical view from nowhere that somehow magically lacks situatedness and limitation. Mm-hmm. So also being kind of drawing attention to all those questions around, situatedness and embodiment that have been at the heart of so much feminist science and technology studies for decades. But I mean, a question for me too, with that pedagogical point you made, I was always interested in something like, what is a fusion? Like, could we take queerness as critique of normativity and pair that with something like Alex Galloway's protocolological analysis? It was always something I was really interested in with thinking about the computationally queer. And of course, one of the kind of hinges of queerness or queer theory is its, some people would say it's fetish of, being obsessed with the anti-normative. But of course, queerness has definitely, or queer theory has engaged with this now. But, I would say for some time, queer theory's conception of power maybe lacked a kind of technical dimension, right? So what is normative? Or how do I want to say this? I guess the question would be, if queer theory's conception of power, doesn't hold a kind of technical basis there, then normativity, might look a different way. But if you took a technical basis of power, seriously and comprehensively engaged with that, then you might end up with, some type of computational queerness that looks, different from queerness as we know it. So that could be a way of also thinking about this, thinking about the informatically queer, the computationally queer. And your question is, in an alternate machine pedagogy possible? I mean, wonderful question. I want to make sure I'm not too I don't speak to, beyond my means here. But, on the one hand, when you said that, it made me think of some scholars and theorists that are actually, trying to theoretically work out alternate forms of computation. I mean, it makes me think of like Luciana Parisi and her interest in xenocomputation, xenocomputing. But then again, I'd also just think of, if there's an alternate machine pedagogy that's responding to all of this, it would be emerging and building from all of this work, minoritarian work in media theory and science and technology studies from the 70s, 80s onwards. So like, situatedness, situated knowledges would be like at the heart of these conversations, like the embodiment, materiality would be, right? Intersectionality. But then on the other hand, we could also be attending to that which is an excess of the human. So of course, there's a lot of minoritarian literature around, algorithmic bias. I mean, we're all really familiar with that literature. But if I come back to someone like Luciana Parisi or Beatrice Fazi, there is this other kind of work that's being done around contingent computation, weird formalism, that's also trying to, it's trying to kind of say computation isn't necessarily like fully determined by the human biases that go into it. There is something in excess there, even within the constraints of calculation and computation and determinacy. But, you know, that's an interesting frame. And I think it's just maybe another side to kind of bring in to, you know, to think about, which also, I mean, I really haven't thought about this. I'm just kind of thinking on the fly here, you know, that could be an interesting way where opacity or something.
Right. Yeah.
Also like sneak in.
Yeah. I mean, I have a question about opacity later, but I guess one of the critiques of kind of defacement is kind of opting out in scenarios where not everyone can kind of opt out, right? So yeah. how does this kind of like defacement fit into perhaps an alternative pedagogy? Is it kind of, you know, removing oneself from these structures of knowledge? Is it inventing new structures of knowledge? You know,
right. I mean, yeah. I think the point there is like learning to, you know, just accept and deal with contradiction. And, you know, when I was writing about this in my dissertation, you know, I called this a paradox of recognition, because on the one hand, you know, you have these biometric failures, you know, as Shoshana Magnet, right, one of the first people to write on this in an academic link study described. And that, you know, causes, right, political problematics that are felt and experienced by minoritarian peoples. But then at the same time, there is like, you know, maybe a more utopic radical desire to still get out of it. And I don't see the problem. And it actually seems much more realistic to me to hold those together, that, mm-hmm. you know, you could be someone who, you know, is subjected to these biometric failures. And there could be, right, the desire for, of course, those to be somehow corrected or mended to make the experience of life, you know, more bearable, livable, if that's only the bottom line. But then at the same time, right, you can still have this desire to want out of that completely. Yeah. And I think, you know, to me, that's the important thing to kind of hold there. It's like it's an untiable knot. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, that would be like giving, I mean, right, that seems an important component to come into when we're kind of talking about these things. And I think, you know, well, we're going to get to opacity. But yeah, I mean, with defacement, you know, I guess it's, you know, the act of defacement, you know, the way that I saw it, for instance, like with the masks that I, the kind of anti-biometric masks I was making, was that, you know, they were a political demand to be seen, you know, in the ways in which that group of people want to be seen. And it was kind of, right, kind of calling out that biometric recognition is but is a node within a larger system of political recognition and visibility. And that those masks were calling for defacement, opacity, but it wasn't about like a complete and total, you know, erasure or disappearance of people. It was about the reconstitution of how one is made visible or recognizable. But then, you know, it's an artwork, you know, it doesn't mean that like the artwork is achieving that. And, you know, that's the important distinction to make there. But the artwork can hold that space, can hold that articulation. It can hold that desire for wanting to, you know, achieve that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that segues really nicely into the next question, which is kind of on, still within the framework of these technologies of capture, yeah, okay. But to do with kind of forms of learning that actually go on in these systems of capture themselves, right? I think there's been quite a lot of buzz in the media about AI, ChatGPT, so on, these kind of machine learning models, which kind of operate through historical data, right? Which learn, which are constantly learning and picking up on different kind of language models, different kind of human behavioral models, and so on. So I wanted to kind of think about this question in the context of machine learning and specifically in the context of your piece, I'm Here to Learn. So smiley face, which was a collaboration with another artist, Jemima Wyman. So for the audience who might not be familiar with this work, it meditated on the short life. It was a short film, right? That meditated on the life of Microsoft's AI chatbot Tay, which was shut down within a day after it began regurgitating racist, homophobic, and misogynistic remarks on Twitter. So I wanted to ask about this kind of machine learning model, which kind of learned to pick up these kind of horrible kind of social problems, cultural problems, as well as kind of, you know, all the kind of terrible language that exists on the internet right now, right? So I wanted to ask, do machine learning models motored by adaptive algorithms, historical data, and algorithmic apophenia, which is kind of this drive to recognize patterns in data, does this kind of framework reflect a turn in the way that learning itself is being conceived? And you've kind of spoken about this in the context of Silicon Valley and the kind of evil tech infrastructures that exist within these spaces. But do you see this ethos extending beyond Silicon Valley and the technology itself? Do you see them as kind of being separate components? Or is this kind of like a pedagogical learning model that you see expanding beyond these spaces?
It's an interesting, I'm taken with starting with Tay and you know, that work that Jemima and I made, because I mean, that was one of the tweets that Tay made, I'm Here to Learn. So, and you know, we just thought that was such a great and kind of encapsulation of everything that we wanted to explore within that work, which I think, you know, it definitely relates to, you know, absolutely what I was saying before, was that work was definitely looking at how, you know, within these algorithmic AI-driven learning systems, all of these things can be kind of mirrored and amplified and exaggerated and intensified. I mean, all these things, meaning, you know, racism, homophobia, transphobia, Nazism, on and on. But then also, you know, what Jemima and I were trying to do with that work was let Tay have this these moments of weirdness or strangeness, or kind of like it's not exactly autonomy, but just to let by resurrecting Tay and using the means that we had, which was like basically taking all the tweets that she made, we built a language lexicon with that and reconfigured it to write a script of what she could possibly say. And then, brought her forward through taking her official profile image and putting that into a 3D model that, strange moments emerged from those conditions, strange moments, meaning like, moments of like what seemed like feminist agency or something like that. And I think that work, you know, models, now that I'm thinking about it, you know, a similar point I was making earlier about, you know, attending to the biases, but also what could be in excess. And the work is, you know, showing that, right, it's unresolved. It's a tension, it's a struggle. The work is not, right, and I'm not going to say that I know how to resolve that issue, but the work is giving space to that. And I think with, machine learning, and how that just kind of impacts and reflects on the learning process. And, you know, well, you're just making me think of, I actually just had an AI training, like an AI, you know, professor training workshop that I actually wasn't able to go to. I mean, usually I would avoid these things, but I really wanted to go to this one because I was so curious to see how, right, it's kind of like these university-wide professor training sessions before the academic year starts, and I absolutely wanted to see how this is being framed, right, by the university, and right, how it's pitched to professors about, oh, how we need to deal with students like writing their papers with ChatGPT. So, you know, in a way, with, you know, ChatGPT is such a obvious example to think about the impact of all of this on education. But I mean, if I thought about this more broadly, you know, we could say something like, you know, we're always learning with technology. And that's been the case for a very long time. So we learn with technology, you know, technology is a means in which we learn. And, you know, we could call this technogenesis, which, you know, again, people like in Catherine Hales have written and developed on technogenesis being the co-evolution of humans and machines. And this not only affects the conditions of thought, but it affects, you know, how we think, how we learn. And importantly, you know, technogenesis is non-teleological, so it's unpredictable. And so, you know, in that sense, we could say that, right, learning is always bound to and marked by technologies, technologies, possibilities and limitations. And so, you know, also in that sense, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, I'm not that necessarily you would think this, but I'm, you know, I'm not a Luddite or a neo-Luddite, you know, I don't think like it's a viable political position to just have this total refusal of the technology. You know, it's here. Students will be using ChatGPT to write their papers. Absolutely. And more. So I think then, you know, what you have to bring to that is, you know, you bring awareness, you bring critical awareness, you bring intentionality, you know, you study these things, you have the, you know, the kind of self-reflection, you become aware of the kind of questions and issues of the situatedness of this, the political dimensions, I mean, which of course, you know, works to my benefit, because I teach in these topics anyway. But I realize, you know, if you're kind of confronting this issue in a subject or discipline that, you know, might not usually talk about these questions, then, you know, maybe that prevents a different challenge or problematic, but then that also just highlights the need for collective transdisciplinary engagement within the university. And, you know, you're just on top of that, you made me think of this. I know I keep talking about in Catherine Hales. It's like the weight of like, you know, I don't know, your academic genealogy is like really coming out right now. but you know, Kate wrote this article years ago about deep attention and hyperattention, and it focused on looking at the neural pathways in brains of people that were born in a predominantly kind of digital media environment, you know, versus maybe people in a like a more print dominant era. And you know, I remember in this article, Kate points out that, you know, the neural pathways are different. And so there was an argument here about, right, how media conditions are impacting actual structures in the brain, which then might, as teachers and professors, might make us have a, you know, different approach rather than this knee-jerk reaction, oh, my students can't pay attention in class because they're extremely distracted. So this became the basis for her making an argument around, you know, kind of critiquing certain attitudes or approaches towards distraction in the classroom, and actually, again, kind of attenuating to contemporary media conditions and how, right, there we can bring a lot of attention and awareness to how technology is being used and operated in the classroom. And for her, she offered these ideas of deep attention and hyper attention. You know, hyper attention obviously being the where you've got multiple streams going, deep attention being like reading a single book for 3 hours undistracted. And it becomes a question of modulating that. So it's just an interesting, I think, example to think about with learning. It's, you know, learning through technology, the impact on the human brains and how that shifts throughout time through technogenesis.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I really didn't think about the path, like the connection, so the bridge between these models of machine learning and then our own kind of neural pathways, right? That's a really, really brilliant connection. I also, before, because we're running out of time, I really wanted to touch on your new kind of publication project, Informatics of Domination, which is a phrase coined by Donna Haraway in Manifesto of Cyborgs. It's the title of the forthcoming volume of essays that you're editing alongside Jennifer Ree and Melody Jew. And I'd just really like to know kind of As this is a collective kind of publication project, we're really interested in collective forms of learning, collective projects here at After All Art School. So I really wanted to know how the kind of project emerged and what kinds of discussions and questions marked its conception. And second, I'd really like to understand the significance of Haraway's informatics of domination in relation to the larger thematics in your writing and your artworks. Because it seems like this kind of feminist intersectional periodization of power really informs your understanding of networked life more broadly.
Jenny and Melody and I, we all went to Duke together, and we were all in the same PhD program together, the literature program at Duke, and we all studied with Catherine Hales together. That's how we, you know, found one another. And I mean, we all worked on like very different things. Melody is more focused on the ocean humanities and media theory. Jenny works more on robotics, women of color feminism. And we had been having, intellectual conversations for years. You know, we all stayed in touch after we graduated and all went to our different ways. Melody's in California, Jenny's in Virginia, I'm here in Toronto. And then during that, you know, in 2017, when I was still at Goldsmiths, I organized this lecture program called Informatics of Domination. And you know, what struck me about that was, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways, the Manifesto for Cyborgs is overplayed, or at least I think Jenny and Melody and I all agree that we're not so interested in the cyborg. But what is really striking to us is that there's this whole section in that manifesto called Informatics of Domination that's just strangely underengaged, like hardly any engagement with that at all. And you know, I think we were really taken by this as a mode of feminist periodization of power, because periodization theory is quite popular in media theory. And, you know, you have like the dominant, Foucault's disciplinary societies to Deleuze's control societies. And I think what really struck us was importantly, in Haraway's a description of informatics of domination, which for her is a way of, you know, broadly conceiving, you know, patriarchal power at the close of the 20th century, she identifies this as a reformulation of what she refers to as white capitalist patriarchy. Now, I think if you're thinking within feminist theory, I mean, it's not directly quoted or identified, but I think it's safe to assume that this is a reconfiguration of bell hooks, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. And, and I think the important thing is this is not like an attempt at erasing, you know, bell hooks work. It's what's interesting by creating this mode of periodization. And also I should say the main element of informatics of domination in the Manifesto for Cyborgs is this two column chart that's tracing out these transformations broadly in society, where on one side you have white capitalist patriarchy, the other side you have informatics of domination. By creating this as a diagrammatic mode of thinking, you know, the two are kind of bound and held together, which I think is like really, really crucial. It's not necessarily about one supplanting the other. Also, it's interestingly with Haraway, the more you get into this, it's not even necessarily, we don't have to even have them in a particular temporal order necessarily, you know, depending on what we're talking about. So they're bound together, which, you know, was really compelling to us. And I think, we really just wanted to dive into this concept and think with it and spend time with it and see where it would lead us. So we organized in the chart, there's maybe 30 some entries, and the process, you know, it was a little experimental the way that we organized the collection, where let's say the first entry is representation simulation. So we let a person come in, take only one entry in the chart, and they can add a third term if they like. So the first entry was taken by media theorist Rita Rayleigh, who's based at UC Santa Barbara, where Melody is. And she added generation as her third term. So you have representation, simulation, generation, and Rita is focusing on, you know, AI generated material, deep fakes. And so this is a way of kind of, you know, building upon, right, kind of the, I mean, I guess foundation that Haraway laid, but it's also important to say that it's quite even under theorized in the Manifesto for Cyborgs itself. And so we've invited, you know, artists, fiction writers, a variety of scholars to take one chart and respond to it how they see fit. And these have been like drawings, conversations, standard academic essays. They really run a wide range of engagement. And I think for me, so much of my work has been about, really thinking about queerness and power and technology. And I find the generosity in what informatics of domination brings to the table, really exciting. And I mean, it's also, you know, a bit of a feminist killjoy, which I think we all kind of enjoy. And it's interesting, there is a turn in art right now where there's like a lot of positivity around AI. And I think the three of us are just not necessarily here for it.
Yeah. I mean, that way of kind of even visualizing the kind of range of ideas that you're engaging with in the book is really interesting as well, because you don't typically see even that editorial process being done by the writer, the kind of artists themselves, right? Especially when you're given a project by a big publisher and you kind of have to fit within these very strict confines of what the topic is that you're engaging with, right? So that sounds like a really exciting project. When is it going to be published?
Academic publishing, I would really love to think it would be out sometime like late 2024, but it's going to take a bit of time still.
Okay. I'm going to stay tuned for that. I have one final question, which, you know, we've been circulating around for the entire conversation, but it's based around opacity. At Afro Art School, we've been thinking a lot about what it means to learn collectively outside of rigid institutional structures of knowledge. And you have written extensively about how opacity, as conceived by Edward Glissant, but also kind of in your own formation, can be enacted as a means to evade capture by omniscient surveillance networks, and also the dominant capitalist condition more broadly. So as a final question, I wanted to ask, how is opacity enacted and sustained by creative practice? And finally, what does an opaque education look like?
I mean, amazing questions. I feel like I could talk a lot about this, but I mean, maybe just, I think, you know, both of those questions would be answered, you know, differently depending on the specificities of who you are and where you are. And I mean, to start, I could say, you know, there are a couple quotes that have always stayed with me from Glissant around opacity, which one is, opacity is that which protects the diverse, and the diverse was capitalized in the text. And then also there's this bit in Caribbean Discourse when he's talking about how calling for us to be his collaborators in obscurity. I kind of love this like call for collaboration. Even though, of course, there's like other translations of Glissant where there's this distinction being made that opacity isn't the obscure. But yet in this moment in Caribbean Discourse, it seems that there's some like fluidity there between the obscure and the opaque. But to think about this call to be a collaborator in opacity, and this call or this statement that opacity is that which protects the diverse. I mean, to kind of lead with that. But then, you know, at the same time, I, you know, feel like it's, I don't want to give, I guess, art, you know, art could be like a place where like opacity goes to die. And again, it's more about the, I think, the negotiation and the kind of struggle there. And again, maybe these more questions around aspiration or longing. You know, I love like Jose Munoz's ideas around queer longing. And there's something about a longing there that's always like attracted to me about opacity. And I think maybe that's also another way of thinking about what I was trying to articulate earlier around the paradox of representation, being that like maybe, you know, we don't have these conditions, but yet we absolutely yearn for them. And mm-hmm. like can an art could be a space where, you know, that yearning can be articulated, it can be amplified, it can find others that are, you know, kind of expressing this. And but maybe like also an interesting place, I mean, I'm kind of talking around this because I feel like it's like 20 ideas all just came in all at once. But one thing that's interesting to share, especially pedagogically, is when I was making this mask work, these anti-biometric face masks, I hadn't settled on a concept yet. I hadn't had my moment of kind of concept engineering. And I was going to spend time with different people doing these public workshops, like in Mexico, around the US. And when we were doing these mask workshops, I was, you know, now I kind of realized they were like consciousness raising workshops. So I guess I didn't really think of them like that at the time, but they absolutely were. And we were studying, you know, facial recognition in local context, as well as more globally. But we also read a lot of different writing and philosophy around pathways of withdrawal or refusal, whether that would be something like Tactics of Non-Existence from Alex Galloway and Eugene Thacker, or James C. Scott's ideas around illegibility, you know, different like articulations in queer theory, and Glissant and opacity, also Agamben's idea of the whatever singularity. And you know, what I noticed was really interesting in all those meetings is that opacity was the concept people in these workshops really connected with. So it was like, you know, just through these workshops, there were, you know, it was just this interesting moment of people being on board with the ideas, but like refusing to attach to the specific term. So if we're talking about disappearance, and you know, maybe that is articulating an idea about wanting to withdraw, someone could feel affinity to that desire, but would not want to attach to the formulation of the concept because of, you know, maybe what disappearance could evoke for you, depending on, especially if you're from Latin America, for instance, maybe. And so what really just struck me in these workshops was how opacity was so generative and capacious and just seemed to hold so much for, you know, a very broad set of minoritarian peoples. And that's what really made me gravitate more towards working with opacity, which, you know, perhaps is just an interesting thing to share with you, because I really did move toward it. I mean, myself personally, I think I was attracted to more formations in, you know, media theory, and I can certainly have my own romances with a negative. So, but I chose to work with opacity for my dissertation because of those experiences with those workshops and kind of learning from those people and what, you know, what concept they wanted to form a community around. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, in that sense, I mean, in my own work, when I think of something like facial weaponization suite, you know, I think of it as this like enactment or articulation of, opacity, but at the same time, it's important if we're thinking about it from Glissant's point of view, it's like we're always already opaque. It's not that we're striving to achieve that, it's that forces and structures, things in the world violate that. And mm-hmm. then it becomes about how to protect that which is diverse, which Glissant would say. I don't know, that was kind of like dancing around that, but I think there are, you know, and then the question around like, what does an opaque education look like? Again, I think, you know, I don't think there's a, you know, like a template answer for this, because I think it really is about the specificity, the situatedness of experience, what this looks for different people in different places. You know, it could be an alternative art school. It could be an undercommons, but it also could be something like at a completely normal standard university where something more psychic and internal is happening, or it could be a teach-in, a teach-out, a space that's, you know, not overdetermined by a professor. But I would think that it's, you know, it's always some kind of negotiation between, you know, being able to, you know, right, as Glissant would say, these transparencies, right, kind of like totalizing another person. Oops.
You're still here.
Nothing happened. anyway, like totalizing. I think, okay. Am I still there?
Yeah, you're still here.
Anyway, this point about, you know, thinking about what, how Glisson talks about transparencies and the kind of projection, the totalizing projection of kind of imperialist or colonialist logics onto peoples, you know, how could a classroom, you know, work and negotiate and struggle against that? But, you know, maybe just I'll end with my own personal example, because I think that, you know, it's different for all of us. And because I grew up in the US, all my education was in the US. Also, I grew up poor and working class, that, you know, for me, like escaping into the university was like really essential. And like, once I got in there, I was holding on for dear life, because, you know, I did not have like health insurance, you know, if I was outside of that system. There was just a lot from like, you know, my conditions that, right, the university, you know, provided. And so I guess I'm just sharing that because, you know, I also don't want to over romanticize the idea of the alternative school or the art school, because often, you know, we can look at like the structures behind that, and it can be, you know, people in different financial situations that actually have the ability to, you know, have the financial freedom and ability to set up these structures. And right, it's not always that like actually the alternative thing, you know, as we might see it, is the thing that provides us the salvation that we're looking for. It's so much about like specific conditions. And it's not to say that my education, you know, wasn't problematic and filled with modes of like different types of structural violence, because it was, but it provided me the conditions, you know, to actually like find these other modes of relating, like the encounters with Jack Halberstam, the experiences with Ricardo, and of course, all the time I spent with, you know, people that I met along the way, right, it laid the conditions for me to begin to, right, enact that process for myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. I think that's a really good place to end. So generous sharing your own kind of personal experience within these theoretical frameworks, because I think oftentimes they can be kind of thought of at a distance from one's own lived experience, right? And I think it's really important to bring it in
Thank you. Thanks for giving the space.
I think we'll leave it here. Thanks. Great.
Thanks so much, everyone. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much, Zach.
Goodbye.
And that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. After All Art School is co-edited by Camille Critchlow and Ariana Mercado. This project was held in collaboration with the exhibition The Educational Web at the Kunstverein in Hamburg.
Our music is Space Jazz by Kevin MacLeod or incompetech.com. Keep up with our programs at afterall.org or through Instagram at afterallresearch.